Welcome.
Come on, lady.
Hi, everybody. I'm an addict recovering from the disease of addiction. My name is Sandra. I want to introduce somebody very, very special to me. I just want to say something real quick. I got 2 minutes. He said I have 2 minutes. First of all, this convention is freaking amazing. It's blowing me away. And I want to, you know, I want to thank the Trump and service. Like, really. It's a lot of hard work. Like, I do conventions and service. It's a lot of hard work. But we're introducing the speaker. And I just want to say, you know, it was 2021, right? And it was right after the pandemic. And my father had died the year before. And, you know, my sponsees would say, I feel so good when after I speak to you, sponsor. And I wasn't getting that. And I ended up, I'm from New York. I don't know if you know from my accent, but I'm from New York. And my friends, I was supposed to share at the Nassau convention. And my friend's like, no, let's go to San Antonio, Texas. I'd never been to San Antonio, Texas. I said, fine, we'll go to San Antonio. So I went to San Antonio, Texas. And I made a midnight main meeting, and this lady was sharing. They said, let's stay up till midnight. I don't stay up till midnight. And I stayed up till midnight, and I heard this woman from Pittsburgh share her experience, strength, and hope, right? I never even been to Pittsburgh, and I never heard of Kathy H. And I told her, I'm not easily impressed, right? But she impressed me enough to get her number, and you know, and I called her, and we developed a relationship, and she became my sponsor. And now, when I call my sponsor, I feel good after. You know what I mean? And our literature says, it says, right, that our experience shows that those who, what is it? Anonymous. And with that, I'm going to introduce you to my sponsor, Kathy H.
In the house.
I'm an addict named Kathy.
Hey.
We're good, right? We're good?
Yeah, good.
I feel like this should be up. Okay. I just really want to say, like, seriously, that you've just blown me away with this convention. So the Northeast Freedom Area, you fucking rock. You did some stuff here. You know, the way you brought it together, look, man, like, I'm just saying, like, when you really get to experience unity at a deep level,
yes,
and you really get to experience how service is really like flows and the love that comes from that commitment, it is just so overwhelming to see it and be a part of it. So thank you so much for the invitation, and thank you to everyone who has served this weekend. I really appreciate you. I'm feeling the love. I'm feeling it. Yeah, the joy is definitely in the journey. So originally, I kind of start the same. I came into Narcotics Anonymous in 86. You know, it was kind of like a nudge from a judge. And I went to jail a lot. I just went to jail a lot. My mother used to say, you must smell like donuts because the police are always on you. And I believe today that I was very fortunate. I was very fortunate. I think the only time it really interferes with me, because I've never done the pardon or the expungement or any of that kind of stuff, I just rolled with it. Like, I remember going to a job and the lady said, you got a lot of felony convictions. And I said, yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah, and she says, well, I'm going to need you to write down Every conviction you have, every disposition that came from that, everything that was going on at the time, right, and what the outcome was.
It's like a fourth step or something, right?
And I said to her, I'm not doing that. And HR gets very surprised when you say something like that to them. They're like I'm HR. Like, you know, what do you mean? And I said, I'm not doing that because I was hired before this job by someone who believed in me. I was given a license by a board that believed in me. So you either hire me for who I am, or you don't hire me for who I was. But I'm not explaining myself anymore. And to be able to reach that part of the journey where the joy is able to be expressed because I believe in myself, but also because I believe in a loving, caring power that's the authority. And it's a beautiful thing when I know who's in charge. It's a glorious thing because people and personalities don't have power over me. Because I used to think this one's trying to get me and that one's trying to play me and this one's trying to make moves and blah, blah. No. Because if God says it's a go, it's a go. And if God says it's a no, it's a no. And nobody can stop that. Once I can lean into that, I don't have to be afraid of life anymore. Because I know who got me. And all I have to do is my part. So when I came here in 86, I really, I thought it was really pathetic that you guys were meeting in church basements. I thought it was really sad that you lost your hustle. I really thought that you gave up. Come on, like, you know, you got another run. Come on. Don't go down like this. I'm talking drugstore cowboys and thoroughbreds. Come on, man. You know what I mean? Like, don't do that. Say it ain't so. Don't do that, right? Sitting in a circle talking about feelings. Oh, my God, it was just so pathetic. And I just couldn't understand for the life of me why you would even go down like that. I used to call myself a conscientious objector. And what it was that everything that was said, I objected to it. I objected to alcohol was a drug. I said, no, it's a refreshment. I objected to don't get into a relationship for a year because I was in jail with all women. There has to be an exemption for that. There has to be, you know, where it's like, yeah, amnesty or something for that kind of stuff. If you ain't praying, you ain't staying. Nope, not going to happen. Now, look. I said, me and God have not been on good terms, and I am not going to, like, I burned them too many times. I burned God too many times with the jackpot prayers, but I never did my part. Like, God, if you get me out of this one, I'll do whatever, and never did whatever. So I kind of knew that God had some power, but I didn't want, it was like going to some place where, you know, like, I burned a bunch of people, and then I have to cop, it's my turn, like, to get burned. So I did try not to mess with God. And so all these things, I didn't know that they were reservations. I didn't know that if someone offers experience, strength, and hope, and tells me stuff that has worked for them, because it's evidence-based here. Experience, strength, and hope is, this is evidence-based. It has worked for me. And in a simple way, it says, it's been proving itself, right, in the lives of many addicts. It has worked for me. And if I say right away, no, that doesn't work, no, that doesn't work, no, that doesn't work, then I didn't know that I was making reservations in the program. And I didn't know that reservations robbed me of the benefits of the program. I just knew, you know, there was this one time, my son was using. And I told my daughter to put the IP of Am I an Addict all over the house. Just everywhere you could put it, just put it. Especially in the bathroom. Put it in there, right? And so I say to my son, did you see them those like pamphlets that were laying around the house. He said, yeah, they're everywhere, right? I said, did you read them? He said, no. I said, why didn't you read them? He said, because I'm afraid it'll change the way I think. And immediately I was like, that was it. Because I would not let anything else in because I'm afraid you'll change the way I think. And I didn't last long. It started with alcohol because it's a refreshment. There's a reservation there that led me back. And what I had taken years to do before, in 6 months I had five cases pending. I was strung up. You know, I used to say I was strung out like a research monkey. We used to say that in Pittsburgh. You're strung out like a research monkey, right? But I was watching like one of those animal programs, right? And they were talking about how they were using monkeys for research, right? And they got the monkey strung out on like heroin, right? And then they stopped giving the monkey heroin and the monkey went into withdrawal. And the monkey got really sick for a long time and suffered. And then finally, the monkey started getting healthier again. And after the monkey got healthier, they came back with the syringe to give him the syringe again. And the monkey backed the fuck up. So I can't even say... research monkey because the monkey has more sense than me, right? And I went back out and I crawled back into these rooms in 1988, totally infested with infection. Ramrod through the door. They took me to jail. I had abscesses all over me. I was really, it was bad. I was infected so bad. And I almost had lost my hand. And I hit the jail with the arresting officers, and they're kind enough to take you to the gate. And, you know, then the guard inside is supposed to let me in. And when we hit the gate, the guard looks at me and she says, I can't take her. I can't bring her in here. Now, there's where it says in the literature where you get a moment of clarity, like, where you come face to face with the disease, your disease or whatever, and the reality of, especially because I didn't get nothing in me, you know, so I'm already, like, going into withdrawal. I didn't get anything in me, and the reality of her saying, I can't take her, I can't let her in here. I'm like, this is the jail. You have to let me in. Like, how bad does somebody have to be that the jail won't take me? And she says to me, she's too infected there with infection. We're medically not able to care for her. She's got to go to the hospital. And they took me to the hospital. And in the hospital, you know, I just turned 70. I can't even believe I've lived this long, let alone just stayed alive, right? My clean death date's 12/7/88. I hit 70, and I was like, holy fuck, I'm old. Look, I made it. Like, I couldn't believe I made it. Like, I'm impressed by it. Like, I'm into how long is this journey going to go? Like, I'm really like, I'll be in the back when you go, girl. That's right. You just keep breathing. Go. But hitting 70 is much easier because all I had to do was stay alive. 37 years clean, I had to do a lot more work than I ever imagined possible and didn't even know. Like, I thought I had a drug problem when I came here. And I'm not trying to scare a newcomer because I'm just saying. I remember going in front of a probation officer for a pre-sentence investigation, which means the judge says, let's check and see what this girl's about before I sentence her. So I go to the probation officer, and he comes out the gate with, so, Why do you use drugs to escape reality? To which I respond, now, this is a pre-sentence investigation. I'm supposed to be in, on my behalf, say something favorable. It was one of my biggest problems. Anytime I went to court, the judge said, do you have something to say? Yes, I do. Right? I always had something to say, right? So I say, escape reality. If you knew what was going on out there in the dark of the night, you would never leave your house. I deal with more reality than you could ever handle. What I didn't know was, is that I wasn't living life. I was living in hell. I was living in torment. I was living in suffering. There was no end to it. There was no break from it. There was no breathers even. Getting arrested was like getting rescued. Reaching a point where I thought, well, maybe if they lock me down, maybe I could actually like turn into a decent human being. If you could just get me away from the drugs. If you could just stop that. I mean, I went to the penitentiary and became an emergency medical technician. Like, I'll go to the penitentiary, learn a trade. Like, what kind of stuff is that? Like, seriously, like, how desperate is that stuff? So I came crawling back here. I was wrapped in gauze. I used to keep gloves on till May. I would keep my head down to the floor. I would sit in the back of the room. I couldn't even brush my hair because my arms were so heavy, I couldn't lift my arms up to brush my hair. And I would listen to the readings. I didn't want anybody hugging me. Please don't even talk to me. Can I just sit here? Because this is the only place in the whole world where I feel safe. There's just something in this room, the atmosphere of recovery, the added, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. It somehow just let me know that I was safe here. And that principle is so profound in helping an addict be able to find recovery. And I would listen to the readings. My favorite one is, why are we here? And I was so amazed by the words and what you guys were saying. And where did you get, how did you like know the stuff you knew? Like, you know, we seemed to be incapable of living life on life's terms. We couldn't live and enjoy life. We had to have something different. I can't seem to live and enjoy life. There's something wrong here. We thought we found it in drugs, right? We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. In our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide. But addiction was so cunning that we couldn't do anything about it. Like, I felt that. There was somehow that the words were like, would go into dark places in my own spirit. Like, you'd go in there and touch the pain of how I felt about what was happening to me. What is, my mother would be like, I didn't raise you like this. I'd be like, I know. What is wrong with you? I don't know. Every time I'd go to jail, I would like, I'm going to do the right thing, and I'm going to get out, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to get my daughter back, and I'm going to be a good mother, and I'm going to be a decent person. And addiction didn't go for that plan. And each time I would degrade myself more and humiliate myself more and torment myself more until I lost hope. And when I came into the rooms and I would listen, I remember hearing the most profound thing was, we have a disease. I was like, thank God. Somebody finally knows what's wrong with me. And then the very next thing was, for which there is no known cure. That saved me, because you said it can, however, be arrested. Now, you could have said be in remission or be, you could have used a bunch of words, but you said no, could be arrested. I knew arrested like I was clear. I got arrested. And I thought to myself, I said to him, I'm like talking to myself, I'm saying, so wait a minute, you're telling me that if I do this program, then I won't get arrested, but the disease will get arrested. I was like, you're arrested. Like, I'm literally like, in my head, like it's like a troll or some shit. You're arrested, right? I stuck it in this little cell and had three locks, because you told me that three things were indispensable. If you don't practice any other principles in here, these three, you cannot compromise these three. So there's a lot of honesty, a lot of open-mindedness, a lot of willingness. With these, you said, we are well on our way, right? Okay. Like, there's a whole plan. You guys are so fucking cool, right? There's a whole plan now on how we're going to do this thing, right? So I know I got to keep the locks locked. I know this thing talks through the bars. I know that, right? I sentence it just for today, right? I charge it with theft by deception. I hated that charge. I got about four of them. For selling, like, box of bricks that were TVs. You know what I mean? Like, I used to do that shit too, right? You can't be unique in this place. Somebody did it. Right? Somebody else did it. It's so beautiful, right? And I hated it because I used to always argue with the judge, you know, that how did you know, like, you know, they were trying to buy hot shit. I was teaching them a good moral lesson. He's like, she's like, I want restitution. And I was like, you were buying hot shit. Like, I never could really get with my part. I never knew how to look at my part. I only knew how to defend my part. And so this whole program switched everything up on me. I remember a guy saying one time, he said, Kath, just do the right thing. I said, dude, I've been doing the wrong thing for so long that wrong seems right. Like, I'm all twisted in here. He says to me, well, then just do the opposite of what you've always done. I was like, this guy's a genius. Wow. Yeah. So I came in and I had a really hard time. I looked at the floor. I was afraid if I made eye contact. I didn't know what to do. I had resorted, because I was under surveillance a lot, and there was, you know, back then you had landlines, they bugged them and shit. And so I learned to talk, communicate without talking, so to speak. Right? So maybe, you know, I might look at Darcy and I'll be like that, and Darcy will be like, yeah, should just do this. It was quick. Nobody sees nothing that's going on. My mother used to be like, what just happened? Where'd you go? And then I'll be like this over here or whatever, and she'll be like, you know, like, how many? And I'll be like, I'm like throwing up peace signs and shit, like, right? And so we would have whole transactions and whole communications with no words. No words. So I lost my words. Like, I didn't know how to, like, explain things. I didn't, look, you blew my mind when you talk about feelings, and I'd be like, how do they know how they feel? The only thing I could identify was, I'm angry. I'm so angry. And so when I came in, I kept my, and even if you, I made eye contact, and I looked at you and you looked at me, I would be like, now what do we do? What do we, like, it's like, what do we do with that now? And then, should I smile? And if I smile, do you think I want you? And then, if you smile at me, I know you want me. Like, and then are we in a relationship now? Like, it doesn't, you know. Like, I have no idea what I'm doing here. I don't even know how to function as a human being. I seriously don't. And so I went to go in the circle, and one of the women caught me trying to escape. I used to try to escape meetings. I'd stay at the door, try to get out as quick as I could. And here's why. I didn't want to hug because I was afraid that I'd fall apart if you hugged me. You know, it's, you know how when somebody holds you, yeah, and then they'll be, you okay? No, like it just starts coming out. Like, and so I didn't want that to happen because that would have been, all I had left was like ego. It was all that was left. And so she hugs me and holds me. I knew it. I knew she was going to hold me. I just knew it. I was. It's like impending doom, you know? And she says it. She says the thing. She says, you don't have to live like that anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I try to be like, yeah, okay. You know, yeah, okay. Like, you know. And she's like, no, honey, like, you really... Woo! You really, really, really don't have to live like that anymore. You don't have to do that anymore. Like I could feel something happening in me, like a rush. I knew I didn't take nothing, but it was like a rush. And I got goosebumps and stuff, and I felt like a sensation and stuff. I wasn't sure if I was attracted to her or what was going on. Like, I don't know what's happening, but it was a sensation. And I did not know that what she gave me was hope. Because I forgot what hope felt like. I hadn't felt hope for a very long time. And I'm not even talking about active addiction. I'm talking about as a child. I gave up hope as a child. I used to talk to this God that I've learned through religion. That, could you please like help my mother and dad, could they be a family? Could somebody just, I want to loving and care, like, can somebody really, do they even see me? Does anybody even see me? Does anybody really care? And I told myself that hope causes disappointment. So if you don't hope, you won't be disappointed. Now, what the literature refers to it as a warped, distorted belief system. This is what started to develop in me, is that I started slowly picking away at principles and replacing them with defects. I started saying, you know, if you, like I remember used to say, if you want anything done right, you have to do it yourself. Right? And then I would pick people that would fuck it up, so I can prove that it's going to have to be done by me, right? That's just vicious self-sabotage. This really is. Vicious, isn't it? Because then it confirms that I believe that I have to do it myself to have it done right. And then I don't depend on anyone, and then I don't ask for help, and then I get trapped in self-sufficiency. This is how this stuff starts. This starts with resentments, where I believed resentments where I was going to keep a tab on you of anything you ever did or said that hurt me, and then I was going to make you pay at some point. Because so I always have these tally sheets of keeping score, and then I have to revisit them to keep them alive so that I can remember how bad it hurt, so I can make sure whenever I make you pay that it's sufficient to pay, to make the pain go away. But the pain would never go away. And no matter how much I would do, it wouldn't stop. And I never understood why. Like, I didn't understand why I was buying into all these things that were literally killing me spiritually. The kind of things. I remember I remember my son being real sick, and I had twins that were 2 pounds, 3 ounces, and they were really sick. And my son was especially sick, and I used to go into the NICU and be praying, God, please help him. You can have him forever. Can I just have him for a little bit, right? And he would keep getting sicker. And then finally, my mother's like, could you stop even going in there? Because if he dies, I can't deal with you. You're not going to stay clean. Stop doing this to yourself. Let him go. And I'm not. I'm going back in. And finally, the one day I went in, he was so sick. He wasn't holding food down. And he would. I went to touch him, and he did like that, because a human being touch him caused him pain, because he kept sticking needles in him and stuff. And it hit me in that moment that maybe I didn't know what was best for him. Maybe God knew better what was best for him. And maybe God even knew what was better and best for me, because if he lived and he was very disabled and had to struggle through life, was I going to be the mother that he needed me to be to care for him? And if I wasn't, how much would I hate myself? And so things started getting exposed to me that kind of let me know that God's will might be better than mine. Just maybe God knows better what's best for everyone. Maybe I don't. And I wanted a partnership really bad with some power that was loving and caring. I wanted something that always had my back. I wanted something that was always going to be there for me. I want something that always looked out for me. I wanted that kind of partnership. That's why I never had good relationships, because I was always trying to set the table for someone to be all those things I wanted them to be for me to be okay. And so I started to realize that my part in the relationship was effort and God's part was outcomes. And I didn't have to do any more than try, and God would take care of the rest of it. And trust and believe that whatever the rest of it was in the best interest. This is journey, join the journey stuff. This is actually coming to terms where I start building trust. I start building faith. I start building commitment. I'm building principles that I don't even know I'm doing. All I know is I don't want to live like that anymore. And that has been, I don't want to live like that 10 years clean, 20 years clean, 30 years clean. It just keeps coming around where I slowly but surely start to let go of defects and grab onto principles and try to use them as a first resource instead of a last resort. Where I start to be more like, it's only through understanding and application, and I'm not just knowing what they do, but I'm actually being able in the moment to apply them in my life. I had a terrible relationship with some principles. I mean, terrible. Acceptance was one. Because I always thought acceptance was like, well, you just have to accept it. And I'd be like, this is some bullshit right here, because this ain't right. Yeah. This isn't fair. This isn't cool, right? I finally started to realize in the sixth step that it's not fair is a red flag for me. Because I turn into a vigilante. I go on a mission to make it fair based on what I believe fair is. And I literally go overboard. Because I'm going to insist that everybody like has to admit they're wrong. Everybody has to get in line. And before I know it, I'm the problem. I've become the problem. I remember I used to constantly believe that people say they love you, but they don't, because they are not there for you. And I would talk, I just wrote another 4-step. I'm doing my 5th step on Sunday with my sponsor. And the patterns that were still there were unrealistic expectations, trying to get do-overs for emotional stuff that happened to me in the past, and trying to get the do-over. Like, I never had the happy family, so I'm trying to get the happy family to happen again and again and again and again. Because I think if the happy family happens, the pain from the other stuff will go away. And it won't. Because I have no self-acceptance. Look, if we say acceptance is making peace with pain, acceptance wants to make peace. So it doesn't care how I do it. I can surrender, use humility. You know, I can use any of the principles, but it wants to make peace with my pain. So if somebody says something or does something, and it comes up and I'll be like, you know, I have issues, that is not their problem. It is my problem. Through my inability to accept personal responsibility, I actually create my own problems. Because if acceptance is to make peace with something, and self-acceptance is to make peace with myself, then I must be at war with myself. And that's the whole point of me trying to. So acceptance started to become a principle that I started to embrace more, because now I don't see it as being force-fed some bullshit. Now I see it as, can we make peace with this? How? Because you ought to get a better perspective on life. I need to talk to other people and find ways to move it around so that I can be more empathetic, more understanding, more compassionate, more caring, right? Give people a break, more forgiveness. Like, I have to be able to practice these principles, or I'm not ever going to let them off the hook or me off the hook. And I'm still going to be at war with myself. Like, I have spent years. You know who another one was? Discipline. Discipline was a rough one for me, because I come from a religious background. And discipline was like rollers and getting whooped and, you know, you're getting beat off. You're always getting beat. Like, I don't even know what I was getting beat for. I'm just getting beat. And so I saw discipline as being punishing. But when I look discipline up, it says it comes from the word disciple. And disciple is one who follows what is known. So when I'm practicing self-discipline, I'm practicing the principles that the steps have offered me to live by. And I'm doing it by application of them, because I know they work. I know they work because many people before me have told me that they work. So when ego jumps in and tries to run stuff, I know that the best thing for me to do is practice humility. And that's, humility isn't thinking less of myself, it's just thinking of myself less. It's to stop always like making it about you. Stop taking shit so personal. Right? We'll be like, I was having a thing. We say, you're pushing my buttons, she says. You're pushing my buttons. I say, I can't push your buttons unless you give me permission. What? You own your own buttons. They're your buttons. I don't have the power to go in there and start pushing. I say something and you feel that? That's because something is coming up that wants to be made peace with. Something is saying, please help me. This is disturbing my spirit. Please help me make peace with it. That's my job. Not me to control everybody else with, you know they're my buttons, why do you keep saying that? Why do you do that? No, they're not responsible for that. I'm responsible for it. And I never knew that. I never knew that, like, look, I spent a huge amount of time becoming familiar with the disease of addiction. Know the enemy. Know the enemy. Know how it talks, how it moves, what it does, what it's using against me. Because the old belief system that I've had in the past to try to survive is the very thing the disease of addiction is using against me. And that's why it works so well. Because I used it for so many years. So it's very familiar. What? There's a distorted sense of security in familiar pain. Oh, yeah. Where I scare myself, even. I scare myself with thoughts that come through my head and not realize, look, Recovery and Relapse says that an addict, it even says who by any means, but an addict, right, who has free choice. This is on like page 77, and I rarely do this. I'll be like, they'll be like, well, where's it out in the book? Well, read the fucking book. I don't know what to say. You'll find it. Read it. An addict who has free choice over impulsive thinking and compulsive action has reached a turning point in their recovery, which could be a decisive factor. Right? It's talking about the shift. It's saying if you can hold up a minute and you can listen to the thought that comes in my head, if I can listen to it, and then I can say to myself, do I really believe that? Do I really believe I'm not worthy? I'm not good enough? I'm never going to amount to anything? Do I really believe in impending doom constantly? As soon as something happens, I think, oh my God, then everything's going to fall apart, and then everybody's going to be doomed, and I'm not going to, Humpty Dumpty will never put me back together again. That stuff. I scare myself. And come to terms with, look, we still talk a lot about prayer and meditation. So if prayer is talking and meditation is listening, then who am I talking and listening to? Am I listening to the disease? Because I spent more years listening to the disease than I did a loving, caring power. I spent more time practicing defects than I have principles. Right, I've ruled them out. Honesty's not the best policy. I remember one time I was having a party for my kids. I think that they were a year old, and we were out having a picnic. It was hot as fuck. It was hot, and I was sweating. And my father's standing over there with a bottle of beer, and the beer's sweating too. Right, the beer's sweating. I'm sweating, and I got caught in it, the trance of the beer and me. That's all that was there. The beer and me. And my father notices and he says, what is wrong with you? And I say, this is my father. This guy had 5 bonds on me at one time. Right? He's gotten me out of jail, come to visit me in penitentiary. Like, this is the guy that got the brunt of the trauma of my living to use and using to live. And I said to him, well, I want to have a beer. Right? Like, just tell on yourself. Tell on the disease. You always told me. Tell on the disease. Because I remember I thought, wait, you want me to tell on myself? Like, I'm not telling on myself. Prove it. Prove it. Because I'm not telling on myself. But you're like, no, you got to tell on the disease. Expose it. Because if you expose it, it doesn't have power. Right, if you get it out of the dark and bring it to the light, it just disappears, right? And so I said, I want a beer. He said, well, go get one. I said to him, I can't do that. I'll lose my clean date. That's like my important date. That's my I'll lose my clean date. He says, don't tell anybody. Oh, this is my guide. I'm saying this stuff was embedded in me and reconfirmed again and again and again. And I have to work really hard to not let it get a grip on me again. So whenever I'm listening to what's going on into my head, that thought that comes, I have to say, do you believe that or not? Like, because I know whenever I hear, you know, you're not worthy, you're not good enough, I'm able to shift that. And say, that's not true, because God said I'm worthy. God said I have a purpose. God said my life has meaning. God said everything that has ever happened to me is no longer a tragedy. It's a treasure. because it can help those that are suffering. And so you can't tell me that anymore, because God doesn't say that. And you don't know that because you can't hear God. And the disease gets powerless because it has no comeback for my belief in the principles. If I don't have a strong belief in the principles, the disease will catch me off guard. And how it catches me? Through the triangle of self-obsession. Like if we had a trap house in recovery, the triangle of self-obsession is a trap house. Right? It's a trap house based in anger, resentment, and fear. It's constant. There's a constant thing happening where I'm able, like I know when I scare myself, my stomach flips immediately. I'll be like, hold up, what just happened? What just happened? What did I just think that scared me like that? And then I have to shift stuff. The more I practice that, like the more I try and practice, the better it gets. It starts to become second nature for me now. And I'm not saying that I don't ever get trapped. I thought for decades in recovery that I was always going to get trapped by the disease, and I was always going to have to work my way out of the triangle. There's a way out. It was always a way out of the triangle. What I found out was that if I really have a conscious if I pay attention in the moment, because conscious is awake, wake up, wake up. Be alert to what's going on here. If I pay attention, that when the thought comes, oh my God, wait a minute. If God doesn't force goodness on me, the disease can't force self-destruction on me either. I have to accept the invitation. So when the thought comes, the way I accept the invitation is I give it energy. I focus on it and I believe it. Believing something gives it energy. Now, because if I believe it, it must be true. If it's true, then that becomes my reality. And I have to work really hard to be able to say that is not true, but I also have to be able to say why it isn't true, to be able to shift it. So now I am aware that the disease has to invite me into the triangle. It doesn't just throw me in there. It has to invite me. I have to agree. Whenever I hear that stuff about you need to let them know who you are, you better check them before they start taking advantage of you. They're going to think you're prey. They're going to try to get over on you. All that ego stuff that doesn't serve me any well anymore. Because why? Because I believe I'm a trusted servant. I believe I was created for a purpose. I believe my life has meaning. I don't have to be ashamed of anything anymore. I don't have to feel guilty about anything that went down. I am able to use everything that's ever happened to me to help another human being. And that's the void that I had my whole life, where my mother would say, you were so needy. Somebody else was sharing about it earlier. No matter how much they got attention, love, care, it was never enough. Because the void was there. And the void is that my life has purpose and meaning, and I am a difference in life. I make a difference in life. I am of something good. This is what the group does for us. This is what the traditions do for us. I'm a part of something good. This is what the symbol is about. It's about what? Self is the 12 steps, society's 12 traditions, service is the 12 concepts, and God is the relationship with the God of our understanding. With those comes goodwill. I finally feel like I'm a good person, like I'm a decent human being, that I have value, that I am loved, that I am enough, that I'm finally worthy, and that I don't have to ever live like that anymore. My daughter still was a nurse, and she said, what did you want to be when you were little? And I said, I wanted to be a nurse. But I live vicariously through you because I have all those felony convictions. And she says to me, you talk all this stuff about God, but do you just talk it? You don't live it? Bitch. Because she's talking about courage now. She's talking about taking a risk. She's talking about, right, putting myself out there. So even though I'm pissed, I say, fine. So I apply for a nursing program. They let me in. I apply for my nursing license, my graduate license. They say, no, you got felony convictions. I know, I told you that. They said, but if you take your NCLEX and you pass the NCLEX, we'll give you a nursing license. Now, I had many conversations with God about this nursing thing because I was already hitting 50 and it was getting a little late to be doing that kind of stuff. It was a big investment of a lot of time, energy, and effort. What if I don't get what I want? What if I do all that work and I don't get what I want? And I remember the day that it hit me, this is not about getting what you want. It's about believing enough in yourself to go after what you dreamed of. And once I realized that, then whatever happened, happened. But I'd be like, God, it'd be really nice if you could fit this in your will. I'd be cool with it. But if you don't, I get it. But at least I believed enough in myself to give it my best effort to try. The try is everything. It's effort to try to get a better perspective. I'll have a program, I'll try to follow it to the best. It's the try that's everything. So she said, I take the NCLEX, boom, get a license, right? Great. Now I can't get a job. I said, should I have prayed about that too? Like, did you? That was like all in there. It was all in there. The whole thing was like, it was a blanket prayer. Please, God, don't bring me this far to say psych. Please. So I apply for all these jobs. I can't get a job anywhere because of my convictions. And all of a sudden, I get the call. And the call says, we're gonna hire you. Oh, great. For where am I going? You're going to a psych nurse position. Oh, God said psych. God said psych. I go to the floor the first day there. I can't believe it. I get lost dreams awaken, new possibilities arise. Can't believe it. It's like, this is like miraculous. This can't even be happening to me. I know it happens to you, but it's happening to me. And I'm on the floor, and this guy's yelling, big dude, where's my nurse? Where's my nurse? Where was my nurse? And it dawns on me that I'm his nurse. And I'm a wreck, like, oh, I'm his nurse. How do I know I'm his nurse? So I go out in the hall and I say it. This is like fifth step stuff, where it has to come from our own lips in order for it to be real, right? You can't just write it down and not say it. Say it. Say it. And I'm on the hallway and I said, I'm your nurse. And he comes running towards me, and I realize in that moment, I am a nurse. Oh my God, this is a miracle. Whatever he wants, I'll do it. I don't even care. Because I'm a nurse. And I retired as a nurse. And so I retire, and I want to do the, I want to go to Florida, do the retirement thing, and blah, blah, blah. But my mother's very sick, and she needs someone to care for her. So I stay home, and I want to help her because there was just so much damage in that relationship that I knew it needed a lot of help. And the funny thing was, is while the years, I love you, Dev, as the years went on, we got to address things that, you know how we say you can't change your past? I found out I can. And what I found out, I can change my past, if I can get a better perspective on it. And so my mother and I started having conversations about situations that happened. In 1 year, I happened to walk through the living room and she had one of them silver trees up for Christmas. I hate them fucking trees. I hate them. And I said out loud, I hate that tree. My mother went over to that tree and ripped it to shreds. Scared the shit out of me. I was like petrified and she just went totally off. And so the one day we were running past this drugstore that had one of those silver trees in the window. And I said to her, like, Mom, remember that silver tree we had when for Christmas time? And she said, yeah, I remember. And I said, yeah, but you ripped it all down. And she said, yeah, because I didn't have money to buy a Christmas tree that year. And your grandmother had this tree in the basement that she said I could have. And I put that tree up because that's all the best, was the best I could do for that Christmas. And I felt empathy and compassion for my mother instead of being so consumed in my own trauma. And in that moment, I made peace with my pain and got a much better understanding. It's we seek to understand rather than being understood. And in that moment, I saw the frailty of my mother and the struggle that went with her being a single parent and how she kept it to herself because she didn't want me to bear the cross that she was afraid of. And I learned a whole nother respect for my mother because of that. And that's one of many experiences that we had together while I was caring for her. I was really caring for us. And so the time came, she passed, and I bought a place down in Florida, little 55-plus, like mobile homes kind of thing. That's the best I could do, because the best I can do is good enough. It's good enough. It's the dream. I don't care. It's the dream. And then I go to apply in this 55-plus community, and doesn't this manager say, we have to do a background check. I'm like 68 years old. Is this never going to go away? So I tell the real estate agent and the manager, I had some stuff in the past that doesn't really look too good, but it was a very long time ago, and I'm not that same person anymore. And she says, okay, we'll just see what happens. And the woman calls me a couple weeks later, and she says, I got your background check. Fuck. She says, there's nothing on it. There's nothing on it. I just started crying. There's nothing on it. There's a mistake, I said. Are you sure you spelled my name right? Yes, and there's nothing. Nothing came back at all. You have nothing there, and you're welcome to come to our community. So I sold my house, and I moved to Florida. I'm living my dream. I don't even travel like I used to because I'm in a tropical paradise with oceans and palm trees and old people. It's like living in Pleasantville. They wave. I've become a kind person, a kind, caring person. I watch the birds. I hear them sing. I hated the birds. I'm not who I was. I'm impressed by what you've done for me, how you've changed me. My son, when he was little, used to have real thick glasses. He never got picked to be on any of the teams. He'd be the last person picked, like whatever. He comes home one day and says, Mommy, you're picked to be the captain of the team. Oh, yes. Like, you know what I mean? Retribution. I said, did you pick all the good kids to be on your team? Well, I picked the kid that doesn't get picked. But after that kid, you pick the good kids that they can. No, I picked the kids, all of them. They don't get picked. Okay, but God intervened. Thank you. But God intervened, and you won the game. No, Mom, he said we got beat real bad. So I say, oh, son, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry that happened. And he said, no, Ma. We're just happy we got picked. Like, we got picked. We were chosen because we were the outcasts of the world. And our long experience as addicts has made us humbly alert to the desperate cries that come from the lonely hearts of addicts everywhere. I'm an addict named Kathy.
Big mouth.